Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk. Various Democrats are continuing to make plans to run for president, or not. For example, billionaire activist Tom Steyer, who had been considering a run, announced on Wednesday that he is not going to run for president. But actually, today we are not going to focus on the Democrats. Instead, we are going to focus on whether or not any Republicans other than Trump, that is, are planning on running for president themselves. So the past three presidents have avoided serious primary challenges. But of course, there are plenty of presidents in the past who were primaried and maybe even politically damaged as a result. So we're going to look back on that history and also discuss the likelihood of a serious primary challenge to Trump in 2020. And here with me to do that are senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hey, Perry, how's it going?
Hey, good to talk with you, Galen.
Good to talk to you, too. And also with us is 538 contributor Julia Azari. She's a presidential scholar and also currently the distinguished visiting scholar at the Kluge Center at the Library of Congress. Julia, congratulations on that distinction, and also good to have you.
Thank you so much, Galen. Good to be here.
For starters, what do we mean by a serious primary challenge? Because, like, technically, Obama did have primary challengers in 2012. It's just that they didn't make it onto the ballot in a lot of places and no one ever really heard of them. So what do we mean by serious, Perry?
So I wrote a piece like looking at this issue, and when I started with the primary that I can remember, the last primary where the incumbent president was considered in danger of losing, and the last time that happened was in 1992, Pat Buchanan ran a kind of populist campaign. If you look back, Buchanan's campaign is eerily similar in terms of its messaging to Trump's 2016. Anyway, Buchanan runs. He gets 37% in New Hampshire. That was the state he really keyed on. Bush didn't really campaign against him, but 37% was pretty high. And then Buchanan got about 25% or so in 11 other states. So that's the last one we've had that was substantial. Before that, in 1976, against Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan won about 38% of the delegates overall. 4 years later, against Jimmy Carter, Ted Kennedy won about 40% of the delegates. So those are much more serious. Buchanan won, I think, something like 2% of the delegates. So he was much weaker. But I think Buchanan is a memorable one for people. So I kind of use that as a baseline.
All right, Julia, do you agree with that characterization as far as serious primary challengers go? Pat Buchanan or better?
Yeah, Pat Buchanan or better is good. I think the other important element of this is that it's someone who is able to command kind of a broad national platform to articulate some other vision of what the party stands for than what the incumbent president is doing. So I think that sort of distinguishes the Buchanan situation in 92 and Ted Kennedy in 1980 and Reagan in 1976. All of them were able to, you know, as part of competing in primaries and competing for delegates, were able to present not just like I'm some rando in the party and I'm going to run for president against the sitting president to like get my name out there, but were able to articulate something about what the party meant that the president wasn't addressing to their satisfaction.
We will get more into that. But in order to kind of set the table a little bit, 89% of people who identify as Republicans approve of the job that Trump is doing. And that's significantly better than either Clinton or Obama were doing within their own parties at this point in their presidencies, compared with George W. Bush. Trump is doing about the same. None of those three recent presidents had primary challenges. If Trump is doing about the same or better within his own party, like, why is it even worth talking about whether he's going to get a primary challenge? Should we just assume he has the nomination in the bag? He shouldn't be worried about it.
I don't assume that, and I wrote the piece in part because I don't think in 2011 you had sort of prominent people in the Democratic Party saying, I'm not sure about Obama. So the fact that the elites are talking about it, like, you know, John Kasich or like Jeff Flake, is relevant here because it only takes one of them to run to start, you know, and to do okay to start a primary. So Obama's approval rating was about 80% among Democrats in 2011. And my guess is if a Bill Clinton, like a conservative Democrat, had run against Obama and sort of said he was too liberal, That person probably could have won, say, West Virginia or Kentucky. They could have run a reasonable campaign, I think. So part of it is, if there is a sort of an elite person in the party who says they want to challenge you and sort of really does that, I think that will sort of create a narrative there that maybe does, that'll sort of show where the voids are. Clinton and Obama probably could have faced a semi-serious primary, but no one decided to run against them, versus I think there's a lot of demand among that Never Trump crowd to have somebody run against Trump.
So this seems like a good time to trot out my theory of Trump's Republican approval. And I think part of the reason that it's so high is a little bit counterintuitive, and is the fact that his presidency has been so embattled. I think that there's a certain amount of ego protection happening there. I don't want to undercut the sincerity of what people are saying. I think that for the most part, you know, people who have sincerely held Republican aligned beliefs are, you know, approve of much of what Trump has done. But I also think the fact that his presidency has kind of been so embattled, and I'm not sure what the word even is for what went on in the 2016 primary, but whatever that is, I think that people now who identify as Republicans and for whom Trump is their party leader, are, you know, there's some degree of defiance against some of the narratives about, you know, why some people think Trump is unfit or whatever. My point there is that some of that support, we don't know how strong it is, right? We don't know how deeply felt it is. And so maybe that some people, when they're asked in a poll, do you support the president, they're going to say yes, but if given another option, some of those people, I think, might say, you know, I like the things that I like about Trump, I would like even more if John Kasich were doing them, or if Jeff Flake were doing them, or someone who's a little bit more standard conservative Republican, who is particularly maybe who's more reliable on standard foreign policy priorities for Republicans.
Okay, so let's try to put numbers to that. Do we have a sense of how big the universe of possible defectors is, or even independents who would consider voting in a Republican primary against Trump?
So PRRI is a polling firm. They did a poll like late last year, and what they asked was people who identify as Republicans but also Republican leaners. That means basically independents but who lean Republican and tell pollsters that. So that's an important distinction, because Gallup is really telling us in terms of like purely Republicans. But if you're a Republican leaner, you could decide to vote in the primary in most states, or you could register as a Republican and vote in every state. So what they found was 66% of people who are Republicans or Republican leaners said, I would vote for Trump as the nominee of the party if I could. And then a third, 33%, said I would vote for someone else. So of course, someone else was not named. It was like they would consider voting for someone else. But a third is a significant number. So that's kind of what we maybe want to do the story in part.
That all seems very reasonable to me. I would also add that it will depend in part on the political conditions at the time. And some of, you know, going back to 1980 and the challenges against Carter, I think that's a little bit complicated, because Kennedy challenged Carter and kind of explicitly from the left. But the reason that I think there was some reception to that challenge was because things were kind of falling apart on Carter, and, you know, economically and in the foreign policy arena. And I think that's sort of similar to Trump. It'll be sensitive to political conditions. If the economy's strong, then I think that number goes down. If the economy's weak, then I think that number goes up. And it's not necessarily all purely mapped onto ideology or party faction.
What is the time range that we're looking at in order to determine whether or not a Republican is going to jump into the primary? Is it the end of the summer? Is it the beginning of 2020?
This is a good question, and I don't think I have a firm answer to it, because I think we're talking about one person running. And as soon as they ran, they would get a huge amount of media attention. So I think if they just announced in like November 2019, they could run a pretty substantial campaign, if even if the primary start late January or in February. So I don't think you need to announce, like, it's not like you're Cory Booker and, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Kestrel are already running and you've got to get your name out there. I don't think we're talking about you have to have a long ramp. Once you announce, it's going to be, whoa, someone's in New Hampshire and they're a challenger. I think that'll sort of take care of itself. I think Buchanan, if I remember correctly, announced in November or December. This is a different period of the world's history. But Buchanan announced in November, December 1991, and the primary was like, you know, 2 months away. So I don't think you have to announce that early. I do think, and I get into this in the piece a little bit, is like, in part, I think these people will be looking for the situation to open up for them. So I would say there are three things that could happen. happen that would make it much easier to challenge Trump. One is like if he did something that violated conservative principles in a way that irritated the party, like Pat Buchanan was able to run in part because George H.W. Bush signed the tax increase. Two, if there was some kind of bad economic news, if we went into a recession, as Julia noted, I think that would mean, because Trump's whole story is, look, I may be erratic, but the economy is booming. And I think if that would be a second thing. And then sort of like really clear evidence, like if there's some kind of like audio tape in which, you know, Trump is asking Russian intelligence officials to hack John Podesta's email. I'm being sort of alarmist intentionally here. But I think if the Mueller probe has some really clear collusion, then I think that also is a factor that would change dynamics. Like right now, it's hard to see a strong primary, but I do think the events matter, as Julia is kind of noting, too.
My initial instinct was a little bit different than Perry's, and my initial instinct was, though, they've got to do it by the beginning of summer, but I do think that that's a fair point, that they would immediately get a huge amount of media attention. It also would kind of depend on whether you wanted to force the Trump campaign to attack you. So on the one hand, if you don't announce very early, then you don't give them very many opportunities to counterattack. And that's like, if you really wanted to win, that would potentially be the right strategy. But actually, if you wanted to kind of divert the president's resources a little bit, and if you wanted to force them to show that they had to fight, then you would want to announce early and show that they're scared. That would be, if you wanted to kind of do this for show and to weaken the president, I would think that would be the more savvy strategy, is actually to get in a little bit earlier.
Interesting. And we can get into a little bit more of what the worldview or rationale would be of a potential primary challenger. But just to talk a little bit more about the numbers and any potential weakness for Trump, I was looking at some polling of a different question, not would you vote for somebody else in the primary, but just do you think that Trump should have a primary challenger? And the data that I saw, according to Hill TV, 43% of Republican voters want a Republican candidate to run against the president, and 78% of independents want that. Those numbers are higher than the third that you mentioned. And those people, of course, may say that they want a primary but still vote for Trump. Does that suggest that there's maybe even more vulnerability?
Yes and no. I guess I would divide the vulnerability in three different groups. I guess one of those is among Republicans, people who are not strong, who are sort of weaker Republicans. The second is, like I mentioned, people who are independents who lean Republican. And I think that's a group that Trump is not as strong with. And the third group is people. Pew had some data that from 2015 to 2017, about 10% of people left both parties, meaning they went from being Democrats to either independents or Republicans, and they went from Republicans to being Democrats or independents. So that tells you those are probably people who are not that excited about Trump. That's the time when he took over the party. So I do think that percentage of people. So you add the group of Republican leaners, sort of not as strong Republicans, and then people who left the Republican Party because of Trump. I think those are the three groups I would look at. I don't know how much they add up to, but I think they're adding up to probably like something like 30% of the potential Republican voters already in that box of people who probably don't like Trump. Then the other 70% of Republicans, you probably, if you're to win the primary, some people who like Trump are going to have to vote for you still. And that's the hard part.
So based on that, I mean, this seems maybe like an obvious question, but is Trump more vulnerable to a challenge from the center or a challenge maybe based on the same policies or maybe even further to the right, but just with like a different temperament or something like that?
So I'm not totally sure that those are going to be easy to distinguish. Part of what we kind of see with the Never Trump elite movement, which I would most closely associate with maybe some combination of John Kasich and Ben Sasse and Jeff Flake, and maybe Nikki Haley is also part of this potential challenger group, and Mitt Romney also be an important person to mention there. These are a mix, right? The critiques tend to be a mix of the president doesn't uphold conservative values. He's too interested in big government, or he's not a clear Republican on these core issues. But also that is sort of linked to like norms and style and political temperament, which I guess we could call a challenge from the center, for lack of a better term. I don't think those are going to be easy to distinguish. And I actually think that one of the challenges of that group of people potentially coordinating is figuring out what their balance is going to be of those different things and how they would sell that particular message and how they would convey it to primary voters and to sympathetic elites.
So I tend to think it's much simpler. I tend to think it's like it's going to come from the center or the left, and it's going to sort of appeal to younger Republicans, female Republicans, non-white Republicans. I think it is going to be, I think a successful one would probably be a sort of norms-based, little bit of a hint of I'm racially tolerant and Trump isn't. I do not support separating children from their families. I think Tom Cotton wants to run for president. I don't think that's going to work because I think Trump's core base right now is white evangelicals and older people and people who are very conservative on immigration. I don't think you can run to the right of Trump. I think a Ted Cruz, I don't think would do very well. I think it is going to be, you know, like Trump got 46% of the Republican electorate or so in 2016. Ted Cruz was second. So I think those people are not really that open, I don't think. But I think the sort of Rubio, Kasich, Jeb Bush voters are where I would start with. And I would argue those are people who are maybe more urbane and more urban in a certain way, too.
I think that's right, but I also think I think Kasich is maybe among that group one of the more likely people to do it, and I just don't think it's going to look like a traditional sort of like what you think of as a centrist challenge. I think it would also be fairly rooted in kind of socially conservative. I think you're probably right about the race and particularly immigration, that you're not necessarily going to out-Trump Trump, although I wouldn't rule that out either as a possibility at this point. But I do think that such a challenge is not going to look like a centrist challenge of the 90s or of the 80s.
And Perry, you said a successful challenge. Do you think there is potential for a successful challenge from the left or from the center? Because, of course, if you add the primary vote of Ted Cruz and Donald Trump together from 2016, that doesn't leave an opening for a successful alternative.
I meant successful in the way I meant serious. I apologize. I meant sort of like who gets a 30, somebody who got like 40%, I think would be successful in a certain, not a winning challenge. A winning challenge, I think, really has to get into people who are satisfied generally with Trump. And that's where I see this being harder, because then you have to get from the center right to the actual right. And I'm not sure. You can imagine maybe Mitt Romney, who's a nationally known figure, maybe could do that. But you got to figure out if you think the tax cuts have been a good idea, the economy's doing well, you generally are sort of conservative on security issues, I think then it gets harder to figure out why are you going to not vote for Trump.
So let's talk about a primary challenger in the Pat Buchanan category. Julia, as the presidential scholar here, are we able to discern like how much those primary challenges had to do with the incumbent president going on to lose? Like, can a serious primary challenge be the cause of a president to lose a second term?
The short answer to that is, I think, no. And I think the evidence is kind of mixed, right? So Buchanan runs against H.W. Bush. As Perry said, kind of populist. Buchanan became a pretty vocal anti-immigration figure. After losing the Republican nomination in 1992, he gives this fiery culture wars speech and talks about radical feminism. There's a couple ways you could think about that, right? Like, you do that, and then do you sort of demobilize core party voters, and is that part of the loss? I think that's a possibility. But it's hard to imagine that you get a primary challenge from Pat Buchanan, you get people fired up about culture wars, and then those people go and vote for Bill Clinton or Ross Perot, right? Those are not obvious alternatives. But typically what I say when asked this question is that having a primary challenge indicates weakness. And there, I think with Trump, it's just not an open question, right? This is a president who lost the popular vote and isn't terribly popular. The kind of base level political vulnerability, normally I know I'm the person who likes to explore the nooks and crannies of nuance and contrarianism, but in this case, I think it's actually pretty straightforward. Like, this is a president who was, his path to the presidency is very fraught and has generally been politically vulnerable, and a challenge would be indicative of that. And if Trump were to be defeated in the general election, it would also be indicative of that. And that's not, you know, that's not an unusual outcome or development for someone who won fewer votes in the popular vote the first time around.
Why do we have to go back to Pat Buchanan in order to see an example of a serious primary challenger? Is there a reason they become less common?
There's a couple reasons. And some of that is, I think, partly that parties have become more ideologically unified, and they've also just become more presidential in general, right? The president is the face of the party, is the voice of what the partisanship means, is, you know, typically has a very strong organization that is distinct and independent from the party itself. So the more counterintuitive part of this is that we tend to think of party factions as weakening parties. And I actually think that party factions are a way in which parties and people in the party who aren't the president can be, like, can kind of be strong versus the president institutionally. And that's part of it, is like we don't really have these organized factions anymore. Parties have become a lot less internally divided, and to the extent that they are divided or people disagree, there isn't a clear way to organize around that. So I think that's actually a big part of it.
To make a similar connection, in 1976, Ronald Reagan challenged Ford. He was the party's nominee 4 years later. It wasn't considered an act of disloyalty. You're hurting the party, and so on. On some level, I feel like Bernie Sanders was treated as sort of as a disloyal person for challenging Hillary in 2016. And in the Republican Party today, I would argue if you want to have a future in that party, I don't think challenging Trump would be helpful. Even if you got 40%, I think that would be viewed by a lot of the party elites in the Republican Party, even the people who don't love Trump, it would be viewed as an act of disloyalty. Because I think, as Julia said, the parties are more unified internally. They're also more presidential center. Because so right now, being a Republican basically means liking Donald Trump. In 2012, I would argue being a Democrat in a certain way meant liking Barack Obama. So in that sense, I think that makes it harder to challenge a president for that reason. And I think the parties know the data, which is that Carter, Ford, Bush, all challenged, all lost. The other people not challenged won re-election generally. So I do think there's going to be – that again means that I think the parties themselves think if we have a challenger in the primary, that weakens us for the general. So if you run a challenge, you're not a team player, and we're not going to reward you in the future. So I think the odds of, say, Nikki Haley challenging Trump are zero, even though they disagree on some issues, because I think Nikki Haley wants to be president eventually. And I think Ben Sasse in the same case. These people who want to run later – who may not like Trump are not going to run now, I don't think.
I mean, what everything Perry is saying is true, except that I would kind of disagree that it was not seen as an act of disloyalty that Reagan was running against Ford in 1976. It's just that disloyalty was kind of part of the shtick. And the idea of being an insurgent was part of what Reagan was doing. And that space now, so two things about that. One is that space now has been occupied by Trump, and the Republicans in 2020 are facing this weird situation where the insurgent is now also the establishment. And it seems to be that the dominant strategy in the party to deal with that level of conflict is just to sort of embrace it and say, yeah, that's the situation, and not try to resolve that contradiction. And in 1976, Reagan was beginning to command what was becoming an important and fairly organized faction within the party, which was unhappy with Ford, which was Christian conservatives who felt neglected by the Republican Party and felt frustrated by its stances on abortion and the Equal Rights Amendment. And those groups of people, so you have a lot of kind of organized groups in civil society who are ready to vote and donate and mail. And politics was in flux, and the Republican Party that Ford – so first of all, Ford was not elected, and also Ford was, you know, obviously holding over from the Nixon administration, and the Republican Party was in some real trouble. So that's an opening for a faction, and that's a group of people in civil society who happened to be pretty well organized, and Reagan was able to capitalize on all of that. And the stars had aligned in a way that I think opened the door for him to be able to run unsuccessfully in 76 and then more successfully in 1980.
Isn't that an argument actually in favor of somebody challenging Trump and then being able to pick up from the vision that they articulate in that primary to run again in 2024, for example, if he were to go on to lose the general? Like, aren't those actually parallels?
Maybe. I think the challenge there's two things that would have to happen. And one is the question of, is the Republican Party in this sort of low point that they were in the mid-70s? And I think that's unclear, right? I mean, there are some parallels between the 2018 midterm and the seat losses in 1974, for sure. But I think that the strength of partisanship in the electorate means that the Republican brand isn't as damaged right now as it was after Watergate, but I could be, you know, wrong about that. It may just not be apparent in the moment. So that would have to happen. And the other thing that I think would have to happen is that any Trump challenger would have to be commanding not just their own personal kind of brand or whatever, but they would have to be commanding, you know, be linked to an important and somewhat stable faction in the party. And that's where I think having parties that don't have stable factions is really challenging for people who want to mount these kinds of insurgencies. So what is the kind of equivalent to something like the Christian Coalition that or the Moral Majority that's going to get behind Nikki Haley or Jeff Flake or Ben Sasse or John Kasich and stay there? And that, I think, is much less clear. I think there are a lot of Republicans, elites in the electorate and in organized civil society groups who have reservations about the Trump administration. It's not obvious to me that they have a kind of collective identity and way to organize themselves in a stable way.
We've mentioned some of the possible contenders. There are others. Is there anyone that you see as having a particularly strong case who might be able to get the stable faction that you described, Julia?
I am going to say Nikki Haley, and I know that that is not an obvious answer. But I think she is someone who might be able to make that credible argument for a fundamentally different Republican Party. And I think maybe it actually helps that she's been in the administration, that would make her case more credible.
I happen to think that Jeff Flake, Mitt Romney, Kasich, the sort of people sort of known to be never Trump people, I don't think are getting particularly effective. I think that they are sort of like defined that way now. They're also older. They're white men. I do think, I know the Republican Party is, you know, dominated by older white men. I get that. But I do wonder if like somebody who's sort of a little bit, Nikki Haley would be have an interesting bio. I mentioned in the piece Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, who's a youngish, charismatic guy. I mentioned Will Hurd. He's a Texas congressman who represents a border district. Both of them have criticized Trump on national security issues and on immigration to some extent. I think a younger, dynamic person who everyone hasn't heard of. I think John Kasich, to me, despite having a strong profile, is kind of not a particularly good fit for this role. And Flake, too. I think that somebody sort of who we haven't heard of or who most of the electorate hasn't heard of would actually be useful here. That may mean that they're not going to run. But that's the kind of – I almost think the strongest challenger to Trump is someone who I can't recall in this podcast. I think that the Corkers and those kind of people are not going to be very effective.
And that's because why? They've already just been seen as anti-Trump regardless of the current situation?
They've been seen as anti-Trump. They're also like, to me, like there's clearly a divide between younger and female compared to older and male Republicans. So I would be looking for a candidate who was going to energize younger Republicans, particularly women, particularly non-evangelical, particularly Republicans who live in urban areas. That doesn't scream Bob Corker to me. That might illustrate Nikki Haley. Kasich is not a particularly young. I just think the best kind of Republican would be somebody who like brings people who maybe are under 30, who used to be Republicans, don't like the way the party is on racial issues now, and will be like, oh, I can become a Republican again now because we're a young, dynamic. You want somebody ideally who like brings new people into the process. Kind of the way, oddly, I think the best parallel is like in some ways Bernie Sanders and John McCain were older people. John McCain, I mean, in 2000, Bernie Sanders in 2016, they actually brought some new people to the process. I'm not sure, even though they're older men, I just think I don't see Kasich doing that. I could see, so that's kind of what I'm getting at is like somebody who's going to bring people who used to be Republicans back to the party. I don't think that's Flake or Corker.
As we wrap this up, Julia, to put this entire conversation in context, has there ever been an instance of a primary challenger beating an incumbent president?
The closest we come to that in the primary era is in 1968, when Eugene McCarthy is challenging Lyndon Johnson and Johnson decides not to run. It was quite common in the convention era prior to the widespread use of primaries for either for the sitting president to decide not to run or potentially to be defeated at the convention within the party. And that difference really shows us just how much presidents have taken over the parties.
All right. Well, that gives us a little bit of context here. Of course, we are in the primary era. So if anybody does decide to challenge the president, that's the history that they're looking at. And we are going to leave it there. Perry Bacon Jr., thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gail.
And Julia, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. But we will be back with you on Monday with the regular crew, likely talking about Julian Castro, who is set to make an announcement this weekend. That's it for now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.